You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar, where every day is casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday. Tuesday, casual Tuesday. Wednesday, casual hump day. Thursday, casual Thurs. That's what we call it. And Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, September 13th. 2013. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. It's casual Friday the 13th. So Cliff Schechter is scheduled, but will we be able to get him on the phone? Also on the program, who better to have on Friday the 13th, and longtime listeners of the Majority Report will know exactly why I say this, but comedian, farmer, actor, Ross Broccoli. I could probably add philosopher, bon vivant, star of pilot season. Ross Broccoli will be here with us to give us a film recommendation. Also on the program today, it's gotten little coverage, but Republicans are about to blow themselves up and perhaps shut down the government. The Koch brothers, what's 250 mil between friends? Secret, heretofore known, unknown Republican slush fund funded by the Koch brothers is revealed. $250 million. Pennsylvania judge shuts down same-sex marriage licenses in Pennsylvania. Meanwhile, Pennsylvania Attorney General goes after a fracker with criminal charges. A judge in Indiana says their new right-to-work law, unconstitutional, could have real big effects. All that and more, your phone calls, your IMs, your casualness on this Friday the 13th on today's Majority Report. We will take your calls later in the program at 646-257-3920. We will take your IMs later in the program. You can IM us through the app or at Majority FM. And update on the app. I think we are hours, literally hours away from hopefully, knock on wood, getting an approval from iTunes. We are okay to go on the Android app. And
Should we wait till Monday maybe though to do this or Tuesday?
No. We're gonna wait till next Thursday.
Next Thursday.
Where it's not gonna be released. It's just first we need to get approval before we can actually release it.
Okay. Yeah.
So it's looking like next Thursday is gonna be the day to download. Apparently, with a free app to get into the top 10, all you need to do is have 43,000 downloads on that day or something.
But I'm not looking to get in the top 10 overall. I think it would be cool if we got in the top category of our category.
That's right.
I wasn't expecting we'd get top 10 overall.
I think that's highly unlikely.
But if we got it, if we even hit 10 in our niche category,
yes,
that'd be great.
I think 43,000 people downloading on Thursday is a tough road to hoe. Or a tough row to hoe. Either. Both would be difficult. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, the wonderful Cliff Schechter. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. And on the phone, as it's Casual Friday, is the one and only Cliff Schechter. But to introduce him that way would be to basically parade him out in the, I guess, the yeah, it would be like if we were on TV and he walked out in the nude. That would be disturbing. So let's roll his theme song.
Cliff Schechter, Libertas LLC. New media, public relations, and strategy. You want any of these services, you know who you gotta see. Cliff Schechter, LibertasLLC.com.
All right, Cliffy, you there?
I am most certainly here, Sammy. How are you?
What's that? It sounds fine.
Can you not hear me?
We just got a little bit of static on the thing. We're dealing with a little bit of technical issues, but not too bad. How's he sounding now, Cliff?
Hello.
Okay, great. Now, Cliffy.
Yes, sir.
Now, obviously, the big story this week, Syria. We've been covering it right now, just to catch people up. The situation is that the Syrians are dragging their feet a little bit. This was not going to be easy. It's to be expected. No major developments over in the past 24 hours. So let's talk about some things that have not been covered very much this week.
And like the definition of Vladimir Putin's chest when he takes his shirt off.
That's right.
It's an important part of that conversation. I don't feel like the press has been covering.
Yeah, I don't think we've gotten enough into sort of the smallest of bore qualities of the feigned outrage that he would write an opinion piece, blah, blah, blah. I mean, whatever.
Right. If he didn't take his shirt off so much, it wouldn't bother me, but that's my outrage.
I'm still pissed.
He's like Matthew McConaughey, that guy. Can't keep his damn shirt on. I'm tired of it.
I'm still pissed that he's got Robert Kraft's Patriot Super Bowl ring. But
my God, what a dick move. But remember, it was a gift.
Yeah.
Wink, wink.
Of course it was. All right. Well, listen. Okay. There's a couple of things I want to talk about. A little bit about New York in the context of the mayoral election and an interesting piece by Peter Beinart on the new left. Let's get to that in a minute. Let's first off talk about what appears to be the ongoing Republican implosion in the House. This is going to have real implications in terms of we could be looking at either a debt ceiling crisis again or a government shutdown. And we may be just literally now a couple of weeks away from a government shutdown. What we have is essentially the continuing resolution, which is due to come up in, I think, a couple of days, the Republicans keep postponing a vote in the House, Boehner, because he doesn't have the votes to pass it. And, of course, it's because the party is so crazy.
Yeah, this is a continuing theme in our conversations again and again and again, but I don't. Nothing's changed. We elected our country elected a group of willfully stupid people to be in Congress, people that really aren't qualified much to run the lawnmower, much less this country. It's not a joke, really. It's serious. But there are people that just one after another. You just see the recently that Michelle Bachmann and Louis Gohmert and Steve King were over in Egypt talking.
Oh, yes. Oh yeah.
I mean, they allow those three people to actually go over to another country and open their mouths. You literally couldn't find three bigger stooges if you tried. And so these are people that actually represent us in Congress, and they are so dumb, and they're such children intellectually They behave the same way, having young kids, I'm in a playground all the time, and I swear I could sit here and make comparisons between the way kids behave and these guys behave again and again. And so, they don't live in reality. They don't live in a place where science exists. They don't live in a place where reason, wins the day. And so I don't know what you can do to convince these people to do anything that resembles common sense. And morons at the Republican Party, are made up of these establishment Republicans helped obviously create this. We've talked about that with what's going on with Mitch McConnell. We've talked about this on the show before. They created this Frankenstein. I mean, they have redistricted in such a way so that this group of imbeciles has nothing to fear except for somebody running further to the right, which I'm not sure how that happens, unless, you run on, Franco's platform, maybe Pinochet's. I don't really know how you get to the right of some of these current people, but somebody here in Cincinnati found a way to get to the right of Jean Schmidt in a primary, and knocked her out because she wasn't conservative enough. So it is possible, I guess, always to move further to the right. Maybe summary executions on the street for not cutting your hair if you're a man, or I don't know what the hell they can do, but I wish I had anything more positive to offer. I don't really know what you can do with these people. I really don't.
What's interesting is that we've seen these sort of like over the past couple of weeks, all these different stories about how specifically the way that the Republicans have been raising money, have been ginning up their base on this notion that they're going to be able to get rid of Obamacare. And everyone knows that's impossible because the president will never sign a piece of legislation that will get rid of Obamacare. And so what we have now is a chunk of about 50 Republican House members who refuse to do anything that does not involve defunding Obamacare. So the other day you were supposed to have on Wednesday – a bill to continue funding the federal government. They showed that they were 18 votes that they could not get to pass this continuing resolution, even though they had put into it a symbolic defunding of Obamacare. It was basically so that their House members could vote to defund Obamacare. It would have been stripped out.
Because they really haven't done that enough.
Exactly.
I don't know that they're on the record on that one yet.
63 times or whatever it is. And so they cannot pass a continuing resolution. They tried to sweeten the pot by locking in some sequester cuts that still wouldn't sweeten the pot enough for Republicans. Democrats aren't going to help them out. There is only apparently 5 scheduled legislative days to pass a continuing resolution before the government would shut down on October 1st. And so Boehner is running around saying, like, I can't get this bill passed. He's afraid of bringing up a bill that would pass with Democratic support and not a majority Republican support, because that would break his Hastert rule, which we were all
they've broken a few times already.
Yes,
on when they wanted to pass really controversial things like not having men beat women up.
Right.
Stuff like that. They save it for the really controversial things to do it. I think Boehner should just let out his inner Boehner and just go on a rampage.
Well,
he's not going to be Speaker anymore soon.
And he's probably going to leave. He's going to probably leave the House too.
Right, he's a drunk. We all know that. He likes to smoke. I think he should just get a cigarette hanging out of his mouth. James Dean, go Dean style, and just sort of, maybe get a big bottle of scotch. Bring it to the floor, start chugging, and just start punching people.
That would be that would at least be something entertaining. Now, Jonathan Cohn has a couple of theories on why the House
or a good caning. We haven't had a good caning in 150 or so years.
Why the House Republicans are still doing this, and he's got 3 options. One is they are just simply delusional. They actually think that Obamacare is an existential threat to the country.
And to be clear, like, they do say, again, that's what we talked about last time, that got McConnell in trouble, because it was like, well, if this is such a threat, then why won't you do more about it? I mean, they still talk like that. A representative in that, the piece that you're talking about, Representative, was it Fleming from Louisiana, who I think it may be taking on Mary Landrieu. It wanted to run for the Senate seat. So, of course, he's got a motivation to be as crazy as he can possibly be, was saying that this is the biggest economic threat to this country since the Great Depression. Now, like, you either, to utter that statement, you're either perhaps the stupidest man alive, or you're playing to people that are the stupidest people alive. And they sometimes it's not mutually exclusive, obviously.
Right.
It seems to all be one and the same.
And the problem is those people are saying, you know, you wrote the check, now it's time to cash it.
That's right.
And they can't cash it. And so it's just a function. They feel like they need to do this. The other theory that Jonathan Cohn has over at the New Republic is they're savvy. And he's saying that maybe conservatives realize they can't get rid of Obamacare, but they're hoping for leverage to get a better deal in terms of cutting, in terms of sequester cuts. So they want more cuts on non-defense spending. They want to raise defense spending. The problem is they won't be able to get any Democrats to sign off on that at all. And so that's not going to happen.
Yeah, it's not. Yeah, that's the thing. There may be some savviness from Boehner. There may be some savviness from some of the guys that have been around pre-Tea Party. I don't think the 50 or so lunatics threading that stuff, I don't think that's savviness. I just think they're crazy people.
And then
Boehner may try to use them in a way that's more savvy to get what he wants, you know. But as you point out, if it's a ridiculous deal, it's not going to end up getting done. It won't get through that. It won't even get through the House, much less see the light of day in the Senate. So, I mean, I don't know. Again, I don't know what the answer is. You've got, you know, this is like pre-Civil War politics. You've got 50, 75, however many Republicans that literally are just happy enough to take this country down if they don't get what they want.
And
I mean,
and Cohn's final final sort of theory is that they're selfish insofar as, you know, for Ted Cruz and for Heritage Action and for the all these Tea Party guys, they don't care what happens to their party writ large. They don't care what happens to the country, more importantly. They just know that, you know, they've got a bunch of lunatics who are responsible for either getting them through the Republican presidential primary or getting them reelected in their own district, and they're just going to continue to play this game. I mean, Ted Cruz coming out saying, you know, Jesse Helms was God's gift. I mean, this guy's just, he knows where.
You can only have 100 more like him in the
yes.
Senate. Which, right away, it's hard to understand his math on that, because if there were 100 Jesse Helmses and one Ted Cruz, that wouldn't equal 100. So right away, I started questioning that basis. But,
right.
Ted Cruz would willingly
resign from the Senate and have himself replaced.
To allow that to happen. But beyond his challenge in the area of math, there's a challenge of the fact that obviously, this should be the kind of thing akin to Trent Lott praising Strom Thurmond's presidential run in 1948. I mean, you know, this guy, Jesse Helms, as David Broder wrote back in, I think, 90, whenever it was, late 90s, early, early 2000s, when Helms walked away. You know, and Broder, of course, not known for his fierce liberalism or anything that was not cautious, wrote that this basically was the last openly racist person to be leaving the Senate, and hopefully would be the last. That would be the last of what we would see of that generation. I mean, the guy, you know, got on an elevator once with Carol Moseley Braun, who was African American, and whistled Dixie. I mean, he was, you know, this is the kind of person he was. He was openly racist to people's faces and contemptuous of African Americans. So to praise him, you know, that should be a scandal. But these days, nothing's a scandal unless you're twerking half naked on a stage. So
in the final analysis, Ezra Klein has an interesting point in a piece that he wrote today, which is that all things being equal, a government shutdown may be a decent way to avert disaster because it will cause pain for the Republicans, because we know polling shows that they're going to get blamed for a government shutdown, and it will prevent them from doing the same thing with the debt ceiling. The concern that he has is that Boehner and Cantor may just try and punt and say, give us the continuing resolution, and we promise to destroy the country by refusing to pay our bills under the debt ceiling and creating a debt ceiling crisis. But this is, you know, it really is stunning. It is watching sort of a segment of the party just take them over a cliff. And they're all responsible for it because they all created this monster, and now they got to deal with it. But
touched on this because it hasn't really gotten much attention this week in the news, but it also, I think, in some way implicates this piece by Peter Beinart in the Daily Beast, which I think is an interesting piece and sort of reflects a little bit of what I said about I've been saying about the de Blasio win. We don't know, will Bill de Blasio be the guy that we all want him to be, but at very least, it sort of indicates a change in the perspective of
a changing of the guard. Yeah, I want to say I'd read this piece, I'd marked this piece off to read, and I certainly don't always agree with Peter Beinart, but I think it's one of the smartest things I've seen him write. I happen to hold an opinion very close to this. Maybe that's why I think it's so smart, because
right.
It's my opinion.
And that's the way they all operate, isn't it?
I mean, I'm very modest
but,
that way.
But give people a sense of what the piece is about.
That basically, I think there's so much truth to this. You know, he talked about sort of the difference in how political generations versus sort of demographers' generations. You know, you have the boomers who are mid-40s to mid-60s. You know, you've got the Generation X, which is where you and I both hail from, mid-60s to early 80s, and then the millennials, early 80s to 2000s.
And that's when the years you were born, not, I want to make it clear, you and I are not between the ages of 60s, mid-60s. In mid-80s.
Well, I'm like that Benjamin Button guy. I just keep getting younger. but yes, that thank you for, as usual, clarifying my idiocy, Sam, or at least my lack of pointing out the backstory. So to move it along quickly, essentially, instead of breaking it up that way, Beinart's point is that it's political, it's disruptions, you know, economic disruptions or terrorist attack, big things that disrupt the way we look at things politically that shape political generations. And essentially, from the 80s of Reagan through the 90s of Clinton, we were all operating within the same framework. And those of us who came of age during that time mostly, you know, and voted. And when they explain coming of age to them, it's kind of when you head off to college, you know, or when you're in your teens, excuse me, and start paying attention to these things to when you sort of become, you know, move out on your own and start having sort of what one might call it more stable life where you're trying to, you know, during that time, opinions change a lot. Once you get more settled, you know, they calcify and you've got the mortgage to pay and things to do and, you know, and the rest. And I think there's a lot to be said for that too. And so, his point is that that de Blasio is the rise of the new left, which is the coming of age of the millennials who have, you know, basically come of age during a period of time where you've had this great, you know, recession, you know, I mean, a couple of economic dislocations during the Bush years and eventually obviously the huge one at the end where the government safety net has been destroyed essentially, is threadbare. Jobs are hard to come by. They've seen disastrous war in front of their eyes. And so they, on a number of these issues, particularly economic issues and the rest, are more to the left. The point being that didn't always mean in the past that you'd be on the left because the right would use right-wing economic populism, and they still do, of course, to try to bring some people that naturally would be more economically left to their side. And they would play on resentments, whether it's, you know, racial or homophobia or whatever it is. But because the younger generation is so much more urban, suburban, so much more mixed race, so much more, people know people, obviously, if they're not gay, they are friends with people who are gay. And so it's, you know, it's become something where that it's just not nearly as effective on millennials as it was in the past because you're so much more often around people. You know, and you and I have had that conversation before, I think, about gay rights where, you know, I knew people who were gay, but it's not, you know, growing up when I was in high school, but it wasn't the sort of ubiquitous, you know, everywhere that it is now and is accepted. I mean, you know, and so they're breaking the Reagan-Clinton framework. And I've always felt my theory on this that I've given for a while, watching what Obama's done and whatever, history doesn't always repeat itself, you know, exactly. And I don't know that it's going to, but my thing has always been is that, you know, Clinton was operating in the Reagan framework. Clinton was sort of our Eisenhower. You know what I mean? He was a moderate who you know, way Eisenhower had to, was acting within the New Deal consensus.
Right.
He was, you know, was a moderate from the other party. That's what Clinton was. Nixon was the guy that started governing somewhat more outside of it, but all of his appeals, public appeals, were, in his mind, it was still, you know, he said, we're all Keynesians, and he said a whole bunch of things, you know, that, to prove that he was still operating in the sort of framework of the New Deal. So you had to, but he was building this growing conservative coalition around him while still sort of operating within that framework.
Right.
That to me is Obama, who has been building this coalition.
Now, just make something clear. You're talking about it's sort of the mirror image.
I am, and I'm saying history doesn't always repeat itself that way. I don't know that it is. But to me, what is similar about this is that it takes a certain period of time for people, those in whatever establishment exists, to open their eyes and be like, we are now operating in a new framework and things have changed. And there's a new, you know, and there have been a lot of examples from the votes to now in favor of gay marriage statewide, to the voting openly gay people to Congress, to the fact that whatever you think of some of his politics, Cory Booker is going to clean up in New Jersey and he's African American, and 20 years ago that would have been a much bigger deal and now it's not. That you know, we're in sort of a very, you know, the legalization of pot in a couple of states, and now it's going to happen in more. We're just in a very different atmosphere right now, and so Obama's been benefiting from this coalition the way Nixon was doing the Southern strategy and benefiting from a conservative coalition, but he was still governing, ironically, more to the left, the way Obama is still governing, to me, as a centrist and sometimes center-right on a lot of things. And so I think the field is set for the next person in line who sees this new left as this rising force, and more are going to be able to vote, right, in 2016 and 2020, and is willing to take hold of it and realizes, and I think whether that's Hillary Clinton or Elizabeth Warren, who's already gotten the message, or others, to see that that's where a large new left and left center, and really even center coalition can be built, because the vast majority of people, frankly, are with us in almost all these issues now. On the other side, it's a dying, angry, white, rural, largely male, certainly patriarchal, society that is losing numbers in this country.
I think your comparison of the Nixon and Obama is really astute in some ways. I mean, and people should be clear on what we're talking about here. It is a transitional figure who is still operating and talking as still providing some fealty to the pre-existing sort of framework, and under Nixon's era, he was still sort of operating in some.
He created the EPA, right?
Yeah,
he was doing these very progressive.
Still,
I'll let you continue.
New Deal, still sort of like operating under the New Deal spectrum, or the New Deal, I guess, framework. When Reagan came in and then began to demonize government, essentially sort of doing a 180 there, and maybe to a certain extent, I'm not convinced that Carter didn't change that too, in some ways, in some fashion, but basically, you know, turning against labor.
That's a great point. Ironically, with Carter. That's
yes,
a great point.
And sort of saying, okay, you know what, we're now responding to the New Deal in some respect, and to the rise of labor, and to the strength of the middle class. And now,
and even the rise of the evangelical right started with Carter.
Yes.
He was the first born again. And so that's a great point you make, Sam, is that you can't just think about it in terms of parties. You think about it in terms of the representation of whoever the people are, you know.
Indeed.
And Carter was a representation of this new rising force, the way Obama is this multi, you know, this half black, half white, you know, whatever we're calling that these days, but he's certainly multi-ethnic, you know, younger, all that, well-educated, lived in the cities, you know, represents this coalition, but is still operating in the framework of, you know, government is bad, we need to cut spending, and all these other things that millennials don't accept as truth,
right,
as polling will show you.
And that's what's fascinating too. I mean, I think that's a great point. You know, that you're raising is sort of like the rise of sort of the cultural. You know, if you divide these politics into sort of cultural issues, emancipation issues, and the economics. One sort of acts as a ballast against the other. And in this instance, you know, I think we, you know, and I think, you know, Occupy is not necessarily the movement that we wanted it to be, but it was indicative in the same way that I think this de Blasio win is indicative of something that has changed. And
Garcetti in Los Angeles, you know, I think is
Warren in Elizabeth. I mean, Warren in Massachusetts, because, you know, she was a national figure running in Massachusetts there. And I think this is an indication of a change, particularly among the millennials. I mean, I think there are some of us who sort of, you know, even though we were raised under the, you know, came of age under the Reagan era, who continued to sort of have this notion that government is not generically a problem. You know, you can have a problem with certain government policies, but the existence of government. Government can be a force for good. This was something that was completely rejected by Reagan, and still, you know, in that rejection.
And even Clintonism was, you know, use the government, but use it in a way to provide incentives.
Yes,
right?
But
so
he also
not
look,
big government programs.
He came in and said the era
credit.
Of big government is over. I mean, that
right.
is a meaningless. That means nothing other than. Falling within that framework of government, generically speaking, is problematic if it's too involved in things.
Exactly.
And you have millennials who are now saying that, like, you know, we need the government because we are now seeing the implications of what happened.
Well, there's no jobs out there for us. You're cutting, you know, virtually all of the social safety net that was there before.
Deregulation brought us
yep.
This massive financial crisis.
They're first generation who thinks, you know, one of the aspects of that Peter Beinart piece, they are the first generation, I think, would agree with probably things that you and I would say, and others listening to this show, which is that corporations have more control over their lives than government.
Right.
I mean, that's a key data point.
And they
in the argument.
They yeah. also there's a plurality of them that say that they are more in favor of socialism than capitalism.
And yeah, that's one of the most interesting ones. Is that that's been a dirty word now for the better part of 60 years. You know, and certainly during the era when I was in college and whatever, you just weren't good. I mean, to be called a socialist, you know, was an insult. And it's kind of fun now, even to be called a liberal was back then. And it's kind of fun now to watch as these older Republicans, these old white men don't get it, that they still throw around these stupid terms, and think that they're, you know, especially when they call somebody liberal and you're like, yeah, damn right I am.
Right.
You know, let's talk about that. What we've, you know, and they don't see that that's changed. And I think I'm not making excuses here for Obama and Clinton, although I have often said that I think there's a lot of anger at times on the left for Clinton. And my, you know, it may be because I worked on, you know, I got into politics with him in his reelection in '96. But I always said that I think, you know, there was nothing, no left radio, there was no Media Matters, there was no. You know, people like Rachel Maddow and MSNBC, there was no blogosphere, there was nothing except for the stuff coming from the right. And Fox News was brought on then, and I feel like he thought he was operating in an atmosphere, but the truth was he really was.
Well, that's true. But he also, I mean, you know, look, I don't want to get into a fight about Clinton, but he was the head of the DLC. I mean,
he was, and it doesn't mean I say he
represented exactly the sort of forces where the Democratic Party said, to be relevant, what we need to do is bring in a lot of corporate money. And that
right.
was a decision that I think, you know, was we are going to – it is better to win as Republican light than
yes.
to lose.
And I want to be clear because I've been very critical. I mean,
Democrat.
Right. I've been very critical. I mean, look, the elimination of Glass-Steagall was one of the biggest policy mistakes, disasters of the last, you know, generation.
Telecommunications Act wasn't so great either.
The Telecommunications Bill was terrible. was NAFTA was terrible. So I don't want to, welfare reform, terrible.
Right.
So I don't want to pretend that I haven't been critical of Clinton. I have been. The only reason why when people, some on the left will say, well, he's a terrible president, I often try to point out that in this assault, you know, that was going on where Democrats, nobody believed a Democrat could win the presidency anymore, and the left was being hammered and the rest, you know, some things like the Family Medical Leave Act and the Earned Income Tax Credit and some of the environmental stuff, there was some good in there. And you know, again, I'm not making excuses. There was a lot of bad. With Obama, I've been very critical because I feel like, to me, you know, and maybe it's just Obama or whatever he is, 11, 12 years older than me and can't see it, you know, but to me, some of that, a lot of that changing landscape, especially with the media having changed somewhat, is more evident and should be. But it seems like he still, you know, feels this need to adhere to the former sort of
framework.
Well,
I think fundamentally that's who he is. I mean, I think that's fundamentally who he is. I don't think for him it's about triangulation as much as I think he's doing what he thinks is what needs to be done. And I just happen to think that he's on a page that is more akin to, I mean, the irony is that, you know, he's George Herbert Walker Bush in some ways. And George Herbert Walker Bush was cutting against the tide where the Republican Party was at that point.
Right.
And Obama is, in some way, you know, sort of somewhere where George Herbert Walker Bush was, but at a time where the tide is shifting the other direction. And as a Democrat, I think he's...
I agree with that somewhat. My only issue with all that is I think sometimes people simplify it. And, you know, there have been these two... You know, there've been the two crowds that jump out there that call each other names, and you know, I don't use either of them because I think it's stupid. Whether it's the Obama bot or emo prog or whatever, you know, where these people are fighting each other on that. And my view is a more nuanced one, which is I think there's no doubt Obama has a strong fealty to Wall Street and a lot of the values that come from sort of a more corporate Democratic Party. While at the same time, he's caved on some things, and there are things that I think he would have done that would be in a more progressive direction, except for he doesn't have the confidence in himself, so he turns to the Geithners and Summers and people that he thinks are the serious people that know better than he does, and doesn't fight on things. Like, my guess is, if he could, he'd raise the minimum wage a lot more.
Right.
But he doesn't have the courage to stand up and fight for that. I mean, that just being an example. So I don't, you know, I definitely agree with a lot of the analysis. He's a guy who's in with the Wall Street crowd. And is in that, and that's why I made that argument to begin with, which is he sees that framework, he's part of that, that's the way he sees the world. But I do think around the edges there's some more liberal things he would do economically here and there if he could. And he just, you know, I mean, for example, he I think the stimulus would have been bigger if he could have. But people who he thought knew better than him said no, and so the answer became no. You know, I think there's something to that.
But more, you know, and again, the interesting thing about this piece is that it's more about the people than the politicians. The politicians are just a reflection in some way of what is changing on the ground. And by 2016, millennials are going to make up about a third of the electorate. And they seem to be overwhelmingly a group of people who perceive government as, while they're skeptical of it, I think rightly so, they're skeptical, it seems to me, of certain policies as a vehicle for delivering what they think should be done. I think it's quite clear that millennials expect more out of government.
Right. And I think there's a comparison there, and that's why I brought up that data point earlier, which is, can government do some bad things? Can the NSA? Can others? Most certainly. But can government also be a force for good? And should we be more worried about government than should be about corporations? I think we know where millennials come down on that, and that's what's changed. And I just think that these forces are only growing. The Hispanic population, I mean, we've gone through all this stuff, the demographics that have already changed, you know, Virginia, Florida, North Carolina are in the process right now of changing everywhere from Georgia to Texas to Arizona to even South Carolina. And, you know, this is what, and that's why, again, you know, this is not to try to make history reflect itself too perfectly. It could happen. It could not happen. I'm just saying the field is there. The people, the sort of ideology is there for among millennials. The platform is there. Everything is there for whoever the next person is to run and take advantage of all of this. And when people say, oh, well, Hillary Clinton's tied to the old stuff and whatever, maybe, and maybe she won't be smart enough to see it and grab it. I'm doing a straight political analysis here now, nothing to do with my thoughts on her, positive or negative. You know, she bought into that framework too. She was always considered one of the more progressive people when she was a first lady early on. And later on, you know, not so much, obviously, for a variety of good reasons, like supporting Iraq and other things. But people need to remember in the 60s, you know, when he was governor of California, Reagan was somebody who signed one of the most liberal abortion laws in the country. Reagan was partially shaped and went with forces, was a conservative, but probably also saw some of the writing on the wall and what was going on in the mid to late 70s.
Right.
Can Hillary Clinton see that and go back to, you know, if it is her roots, or just alter and become, you know, grab this generation and run with it and become a progressive hero? You know, I don't think because of something you've done in the past, you can't do that. But listen, if she's not smart enough to, there are a whole lot of other people coming up, you know, from the Castro brothers in Texas to Elizabeth Warren to now de Blasio in New York and people like that that do get it. And they'll be the rising tide of the party in the future. And frankly, I think our politics, I hope, you know, there are always things that can change things. I think 9/11 set back some of what was already happening a certain number of years.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's inevitable that it's not inevitable that Democrats will win and be smart enough if somehow Republicans got smart enough, although that's harder to believe right now. What's inevitable, I think, is our politics is going to move in that way, and the question is who will take advantage of it.
Yeah, I mean, it should be, in some respects, I can't wait till September 13, 2023 to see how this plays out. And then I think, God, my kid is only going to be 10 years old, my youngest kid.
I know.
I'm still going to be mired in, doing all when am I going to get my life back?
You could be a young, strapping 50-something, Sam.
Yeah.
Obviously in sort of Joe Piscopo kind of shape.
Oh, yeah.
And you'll be saying, you know, what am I? I have to work though for the next 35 years because there's you know, lifespan is now to 125, and Social Security is cut off at the age of 66.
I think, you know, I'll tell you something. I really think that in the next 5 years, it's very possible we will see Social Security expanded, and I think that's going to be. I mean, I think that is going to be a big.
I do too, by the way. I want to be clear that I'm joking, which I think that was clear, but
right, yes.
I actually think that they
I think everybody knew you were joking when the implication was that I was going to get in shape over the next 10 years.
That started off the joke?
Yeah, I think people knew that's weird.
Yeah, I mean, basically, I think that they had their chance, the crowd that wanted to cut Social Security. They made their, whatever, you know, their strongest, I put that in quotes, arguments, and they've lost. And so I agree with you. I think, if anything, it's going to be expanded. Which is a very, very, very good news.
Yeah. Well, Cliff, fascinating stuff. And really great point about the sort of the way that Nixon was also sort of that transitional figure in some respects.
Right. I mean, you know, you have to look at Nixon for what he did and take the parts out of Watergate and the other stuff, you know, because that's not relevant to the conversation of, you know, where he was in the history of the movement. And he saw that rising coalition and appealed to it, you know, on the right. But at the same time, he still was adhering to the old way of thinking,
right,
which was, you know, government involvement in the economy came to, I mean, to a point where, you know, he had wage and price controls. I imagine what Republicans would do if even a Democrat went anywhere near that today. And that's so really, he actually policy-wise was pretty far to the left. And that's kind of where I feel like Obama is now, someone who's taken advantage of the rising multi-ethnic, you know, multicultural, urban,
it's happening
suburban,
socially, right.
But at the same time has still, particularly on economics,
Well, that's what Nixon did, right? I mean, you know, he maintained the sort of the economic framework, or at least working within that, but really juiced the whole social upheaval.
That's a great point.
And
it really is an exact opposite in that way,
which is
Obama's used the social liberalism to win over all sorts of groups and kept within the economic framework. And so it's up to the next Democrat, whoever he or she may be, to see that there is huge potential here.
Right, to leverage
to be a transformational figure.
To leverage what has been gained or from the Republican, sort of the reactionary side, lost in terms of culturally speaking, and leverage that to deliver what this generation is looking for from government from an economic perspective. All right, Cliffy, as usual, great to talk to you. I will speak to you again next Friday.
Yes, sir. Thanks, Sammy. I appreciate it, buddy.
All right. Ladies and gentlemen, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, for those of you who have been listening to me in the various incarnations that I have had on radio, to the original Majority Report, for those of you who have seen the show pilot season, my next guest needs no introduction, but I will give it. But I'm not going to give it until we come back. All right, we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back with Ross Broccoli. Ladies and gentlemen, we are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. Ladies and gentlemen, those longtime listeners of this program, for those of you, you need no introduction for our next guest, but not all of you are longtime listeners. So reading from the website Sick Birds Die Easy, which is a new film by Nick Fackler, Ross Broccoli came up in the New York comedy scene in the 90s where he experimented with drugs and alcohol. He began to make a name of himself nationwide in commercials and television shows. He was forced to return to Nebraska after controversies over his political views and lifestyle choices. He now lives outside of Lincoln, Nebraska, running a successful organic farm. His role in the film Sick Birds Die Easy is that of a guinea pig. Ross Broccoli, always a pleasure.
Oh, Sam, great to hear your voice.
It's great to hear yours. It sounds like you may have quit smoking.
No, I didn't quit. I'm smoking right now.
So, Ross, what have you been up to?
Gardening and
it's not really
making Hugo cultures.
It's not gardening. I mean, it's farming.
Well, yeah, it's gardening on a big scale, so commercial gardening.
Tell us, what do you got on your farm right now?
What's ripe?
Well, I want to know what you're growing, but you also have a lot of livestock, don't you?
Oh, yeah, we have goats, just a kind of a about a 60, maybe 65 head herd of goats and three llamas. And as far as what's ripe right now, everything, you name it, it's edible right now.
Well, give us a sense of what you're growing.
Tons of tomatoes, tons of squash, lots of watermelons and pumpkins and dry beans and peppers and potatoes and corn and sweet potatoes, you know, everything.
Wait a second. You're growing corn?
Sweet corn, Sam. not the rock hard field corn GMO poison.
All right. I mean, I just.
But I am surrounded by that.
I mean, you know, as long as I've known you, corn has been a big issue for you.
Huge issue. Yeah. I'm completely surrounded by it now. Every direction.
And
GM.
What,
my take on it, Sam, is farming's really lonely. And in fact, the closest thing I have to human contact is with the human genes that were spliced into the corn across the road.
Yeah. And, how's that go? I mean, are you making any real connections, or is it just you guys are just sort of staring at each other?
Who?
What?
You're cutting out a little bit.
All right. Well, don't worry about that. But for years, you were telling me about a Japanese farmer, I think Fukakwa, or I'm not exactly sure how you actually pronounce his name. But you seem to have changed your farming perspective a little bit. Is that right, or no?
Yeah, a little bit. But Fukuoka, Masanabu Fukuoka, yeah, I used to really be into him. It was all really more theory. I've never been able to kind of make that work. But now I kind of can with the Hugo culture.
Tell us about it.
And that's where you make a big deep trench, and then you bury whole trees in it. Maybe chainsaw off the limbs so they lay nice in a kind of a long furrow, and then you bury them back up. Hopefully you did that level on a swale so that it catches runoff and sits there, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And then that water just absorbs into those logs, and the more they rot, they just get like a sponge, and you have these kind of permanent beds that anything you grow, the roots just kind of go down and sit on that wet wood, and you don't even have to water it.
And how's that working out?
It's you got to come see it. It's not. It's beyond belief. I've got sweet potatoes as far as the eye can see, and I haven't even watered them. It's been kind of droughty.
And what kind of trees are you putting underneath that mound?
Anything, but you wouldn't want to use like cedar or walnut or those kind of. Those kind of fence post logs that don't rot, Osage orange. You'd want to put anything besides those three woods, really.
All right. I'll keep that in mind. Tried to do a couple of those Hugel cultures on your recommendation, and they did okay. I just don't have the trees, really, is the problem.
Aren't you surrounded by woods?
Yeah, but they're not big trees.
That's all right. Sticks is fine. Any wood. Anything.
All right. I'll keep that in mind. Now,
old lumber.
Old lumber?
Sure.
Wow.
Anything. Any wood.
If people want to, you still have shares left in your CSA or what?
Yeah. For those of you listening in the Lincoln area, we will be offering a fall CSA.
All right, so go to Broccoli Pharmaceuticals at broccolifarm.blogspot.com. Now, Ross, I want to hear about this this movie. I've seen the trailer. It actually looks really amazing. Did you go to Africa?
Yeah, we went to Gabon, Africa.
All right, so how did this come about? What's the movie about?
Well, it was directed by my buddy Nick, and then, Dana.
Yeah, well, yeah, I mean, yeah, Dana.
Dana produced it, and it's a story about Nick bringing his drug addict friends to Gabon to take this Iboga drug that's supposed to cure addiction.
Yeah, how did that
kind
go?
Of what Ibogaine is based on that. And the movie... We didn't really know what the movie was going to be, but Nick edited it for a couple years, and it turned out pretty good. I like it. It won the Polish International Film Festival.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
And then it makes its U.S. premiere at Woodstock, which is Right, not far from where you are, right?
That's right. It's about an hour and 20 minutes. When does that happen at the Woodstock Film Festival?
October 2nd, right?
I don't know the date. I'm asking you.
Yeah, October 2nd, coming right up. You got to get up there. You got to pump the show, get everybody up there. And, yeah, American debut of Sick Bird Zaidi. We're pretty excited.
And are you going to be up there?
No, I think Nick's gone. I'm broke.
Well, so what is going on? I mean, what have you been up to? I mean, for people who don't know, Ross was a mainstay of the alt comedy scene in the 90s in New York City. Your story is well known, at least for those people who have watched Pilot Season. There was some license taken there, but you did a series of Holiday Inn commercials, which are still widely cited. And then you went out to Hollywood. Have you been out to L.A. much?
No. You?
No. No, it's over for both of us. We're both farming in our own way, buddy.
Yeah, I have not been out there. I haven't done much of that stuff at all. Still do a little stand-up.
Yeah, around the Lincoln, Nebraska area?
Yeah. Just like a show every year or something.
Yeah, and what else? I mean, farming is not a huge cash cow.
There's not a lot of money in it, but there's other benefits.
Do tell.
So, well, you know, you get to be your own boss, and you get to be outside, and you get to bird watch, eat good. That kind of thing. But no, not a lot of cash in it. It's not subsidized by the government.
And what happened with the carp pond?
With the ponds?
Yeah, I mean, you got carp in there or what?
We have carp in the bottom one. We made a new one at the top. You wouldn't recognize the farm now. We kind of tore it up and made another big pond, and then we're going to try to get into catfish.
And what, is there a big market for catfish?
You like catfish?
I'm not a huge fan of catfish.
Oh, I love catfish. Yeah, there's a huge market.
All right. And
I don't think I'll be able to find it, but there is a market for sure.
And so, all right, now, Ross, as you know, I recently had a second child. Huh?
You sent me a photo.
Yeah.
How's he doing?
He's doing good. He's growing like a weed. But have you even met my first child?
Yeah, I think I met her.
Yeah, I think you did, but she was...
I met her.
She was young. You got to get up here. You should have come up with the movie.
Is she driving yet?
Huh? Is she driving?
I should. I would love to come to the movie, but it's in 2 weeks, and we're still in the thick of it here. I'm not going to be able to bust out for that, but maybe there'll be another film festival I can go to.
Yeah, that would be good. But one of the side effects of having one or multiple children is that I don't have the ability to go to the movies anymore. So I get to watch everything I watch on like Netflix or iTunes or something like that. You got a Roku? Do you do Netflix?
Yeah, we have Netflix.
And
I haven't been watching any movie. I haven't seen a good movie forever until Sick Birds. Sick Birds is pretty good.
Well, I was looking for a movie recommendation from you.
Sick Birds Die Easy, directed by Nick Fackler. Story of a bunch of misfits that go to Gabon. I play a drug addict conspiracy theorist.
And it wasn't actually a project to get you off of drugs.
No, but we were acting, you know, that was the story, was we're all drug addicts and that's kind of the
conceit
storyline.
Right. And so you don't have a movie to recommend me beside that? I mean, because obviously that's not available on Netflix yet.
Okay, movie review. I would probably go with one of the 9/11 truth movies. Documentaries.
Right. Anyone in particular?
They're all good, but War by Deception, I think, is pretty good. Missing Links, was that one? That was pretty good. Yeah, it's. Are you still into the 9/11 thing?
Not so much. I don't know that I was really ever into it in the way that you were into it. I'm not sure, you know. But so I'm not. You know, I'm not up on it as much these days.
How about Syria? What's going on over there? What's your take on Syria?
Well, I mean, it's I'm more interested in what's your take on Syria, because my audience has heard mine for most of the week. What's your take on Syria?
I don't think we're being told the truth. I think it's all every war is based on a lie, right? Lao Tzu said that, or whatever his name was, and it's true. I have no idea what's going on. What is going on?
Well, I mean, certainly I don't. I mean, I don't. You know, I don't have access to much more information than you do. You're not still watching Alex Jones, are you?
I'm not really into Alex Jones anymore. No.
Where are you getting your news? Are you watching any news these days, or what?
I like Mike Rivero at What Really Happened. Do you know him?
No.
Yeah, he's pretty good. And I got a Rent.
Uh huh.
And I read a lot of different ones, but mostly I'm just kind of reading, like, rereading history and stuff and learning about what actually happened in history. And I think we've been deceived. I also read today it's easier to fool someone than to convince them they've been fooled.
Yeah, I believe that.
Do you agree with that?
I believe that. Sure.
So give me your take on Syria, Sam. What's your take?
My take is it's a mess. I mean, I think that there's a, you know, I think Russia has a client state. They want to maintain it. The President Obama, you know, spoke about a red line and then was sort of forced to uphold it. And when they saw an opportunity not to... not to do that, I think they sort of jumped on it. So, I mean, my sense is that there's not a huge desire to get involved in this by the administration. They certainly seem to be looking for any opportunity not to.
And that is that a good thing or a bad thing? What do you think we should do?
I mean, if someone can outline to me something that we can do positively there, you know, I might be open to that. But I don't see that we can do anything, and it's a horrible
right.
situation. And if we had the means in which to, in some way, mitigate it. I would be all, you know, I think I would be for it, but I'm not convinced that we have any means short of, like, perhaps, you know, providing aid to refugees.
Well, they're already providing aid to the rebels, aren't they?
Yeah, they just sent weapons. The CIA just sent them weapons. I'm not sure how happy I am about that, but. I have no problem with other types of aid for the rebels, but I just don't think there's a role for us to play in any sort of military way.
Right. Well, that's good to hear. Glad to hear you say that.
Yeah. Well, I
don't think anybody really, except for the State Department, wants this war. I know AIPAC is way behind it. Are they still up on Capitol Hill fighting for this thing?
I would imagine. Yes.
I can't really think of anybody else that wants it. I don't think the military wants it at all. I know the American public is tired.
Yeah, it sounds like you've been listening to my show. Have you been listening to my show?
I need to. I need to get some Wi-Fi out here or something, and I can tune you in.
Yeah, or what do you got? What kind of phone do you have?
just an old cell phone. I can't get any internet on it. But I will tune in. I'm really I'm encouraged that you're speaking out against the war. Is there an exit strategy for us over there? Is there any way we can get out of this mess?
Well, I think the idea is just don't get into it in the first place.
Right. Well.
All right. What else you got for me, boss?
What's that?
What else you got?
Not much. I kind of read about it and just cross my fingers. I think the dollar collapse is going to be tied in here, too. Is there any way we can start a new bank, Sam, and find a sound currency that's going to not collapse? What's your take on the dollar?
I'm not too concerned about the currency collapsing. That's not weighing on me very heavily.
Okay. Well, that's good. You think the dollar is going to be all right when nobody buys the bonds anymore and the rates go to 5%?
I don't think that that's going to happen. Where do you think they're going to spend their money? Where do you think they're going to put their money besides New York real estate?
I don't know if there's going to be any money left. There's no money. The banks aren't loaning much money.
Well, but no, wait a second. You're saying that no one's going to buy our bonds anymore. There's people out there with money who want to buy the bonds. If they stop buying the bonds, where are they going to put their money?
Yeah, I don't know. Farming.
Farming? Well, that's
we need a new agricultural vision for America. We can reinvest in small town America. You're into it.
Yeah, I'm all for it. And I would recommend, if you're someone out there who's been in the business of buying hundreds of millions of dollars of U.S. bonds, I would say I would just start to get ahead of the curve and go to broccolifarm.blogspot.com and
buy farmland. That's what China's doing instead of buying the bonds now, right?
Yeah, I don't know.
China's buying a lot of farmland. And they told them they're not buying the bonds anymore. So we've got a big mess on our hands, don't we?
Yeah, not really. I mean, they constitute about 9% of all our bond sales. So if they taper off, I'm not terribly concerned. But all right, Ross, I'm very excited to see about to see Sick Birds Die Easy. Hopefully, it'll be on Netflix soon. Keep me.
Yeah, and it's only an hour for you. You can get up there to Woodstock, can't you?
Yeah, maybe I will. I may try. I may try and do it.
Cool.
All right.
I'll email you with the times.
Okay, do. And I will let everybody else know.
Great hearing from you, Sam.
All right. Thank you so much. Ross Broccoli, ladies and gentlemen. And now we have a song of the week by Jimmy Reefer Cake. Ross was not in top form. I think I may have caught him he's working on the farm. He's out at the farm. It's tough.
I was thinking as he was talking that he might not be a massive fan of the Majority Report in some ways.
He may
with
find
the money, the dollar stuff. Still but I was thinking of Bush and Chains.
Still into that 9/11 thing, Sam.
Yeah, Ross had some theories that were fairly out there. I imagine he still does.
The food, the produce at his farm looks great, though. If you
he's a great. Yeah. His farm is
looks amazing.
Is amazing, and you can probably contact him if you're in that Lincoln area. It is worth going out. It's one of the most interesting farms I've ever been on in my entire life. He will use anything as mulch. Huge patches of dog hair. He's definitely a unique guy. All right, what is the Reefer Cake song of the day?
It is called Government Loan, and it says featuring the Bathmats. However, it's 4.5 minutes long, so we're only going to be able to play a portion of it.
All right, I want to remind people, it's 4.5 minutes long? Let's play a minute of it. The app will be released on Thursday of next week, folks. We just got word. All right, let's play a minute of Jimmy Reefer Cake song, and then you're going to have to go to allhypocrisy.com to hear all of it.
me, Jimmy Reed Brigade. And backing me up through the magic of reverberation. From around the world in New Caledonia. It's the Bath Mats, the premier bathroom rock and roll band. The present and the future repeats the past. You can find the truth in this podcast. The suits in the media can't be trusted. The bubble of hypocrisy has to be busted. So let's do it. Friggin' institutions, the bigger they are, always have a tendency to take it too far. They lick, lick, licking on the ice cream cone. And they sell themselves another on a government loan, yeah. Sell themselves another on a government loan, oh, yeah. Chase around people and growing
up. Yeah. I'm going to head over to allinhypocrisy.com and check out the rest
really
of
good.
The song.
What's great is it seems like, I'm not sure if you caught understood the Reverb Nation shout out, but it seems like this collaboration is literally Jimmy Reefer Cake is a fan of this band or is friends with this band, and this is a song they put up on Reverb Nation. It's a website where bands upload their songs, and he just played it and sang over it. That's what it sounds like.
Interesting.
Which is cool collaboration.
I love it. All right, folks, we're going to head into the better half of the program. 646-257-3920 is the number. If you want to IM me, you can do so via the app, or which is going to be released on Thursday. Get yourself ready to download it next week. The countdown begins, ladies and gentlemen. Next Thursday, the app will be available for you to download, both the Android version or the iOS version. We will, Matt and Mike will be here on Monday. It is Yom Kippur for me this weekend. I'm traveling to Worcester and back to our regularly scheduled programming. And see you then.
What?
646-257-3920. 646-257-3920. We'll take your phone calls. Sorry, I'm just so excited about the app.